I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the BBC Music Magazine for August of 2022, Claire Jackson interviews pianist Nicholas Hodges about music that changed him. Born in London, Nicholas Hodges sang in the choir of Christ Church, Oxford, before later studying at Cambridge University. He has forged a career as a pianist specializing in contemporary music, and has commissioned concertos by composers including Thomas Addis, Elliot Carter, Gerald Berry, and Harrison Birtwistle, who once described him as like my Peter Pears. He is currently based in Germany, where he is a professor of piano at the Musikhochschule Stuttgart. Like most pianists, I began with Mozart, Clementi, and Bach. Music changed dramatically for me when I first played Debussy. I was encouraged to listen to Claudio Arrau's recordings by my teacher, who was himself a pupil of Arrau. It had a dramatic effect on me. I knew the Walter Gieseking recordings, and I never really liked them. The Arrau, on the other hand, has a fatness of sound that might be considered un-Debussyan by some, but touches things in the music that go beyond the usual ideas of Impressionism. When you have a diet of Viennese classics, Debussy feels incredibly modern. It opened my ears to a different use of harmony. I played Stockhausen's Kontakte in a classroom music lesson when I was about 11. Stockhausen has always been very important to me, and I think it's because I heard his music so early. My father, who was a BBC studio manager and had heard him working with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, had the scores, so having heard the piece at school, I immediately went to try it at the piano. The use of raw sound was so foreign to me. As a child, I was struck by the form. At the time, I thought that Beethoven was the greatest composer that had ever lived. But Stockhausen showed me the importance of contemporary music. I've played Kontakte a lot since, and it's a piece that remains a vital part of my life. I even had percussion lessons for it, and can now do a cymbal roll. I heard Messiaen all through the early part of my life without really noticing. I was a choir boy in Christ Church Cathedral Choir and at Exeter College, Oxford, and the organists often played Messiaen. I can still hear the sound now. I never thought of it as contemporary music. When I played the organ, it was all Buxtehude and Bach. I didn't associate the instrument with new music, which obviously sounds a bit silly. It was only later that I fully appreciated sacred music such as Messiaen's La Nativité du Seigneur. I stopped playing the organ and the oboe in my mid-teens and focused on the piano. I don't think I ever really sang properly. When I was 16, I went to the first performance of Birtwistle's The Mask of Orpheus on a school trip, played music by Boulez for the first time, and went to a master class on Feldman at Dartington. All within a 3-week period. What a bomb! All three experiences were crucial to me, but The Mask of Orpheus was extraordinary for its emotional power. I only have to hear a couple of seconds in the music and I'm gripped. I was incredibly lucky to have immersed myself in 20th and 21st century music from such a young age. I didn't commission Birdwhistle for many years. I had to build up slowly. It started when I got permission to play the Axe Manual, which had been withdrawn after its premiere. Birdwhistle was happy with my performance and subsequently allowed it back into circulation. I was extremely fond of Harry. I've been working with Rebecca Saunders for over 20 years, and she has written 7 pieces for me. The first work I heard was her quartet for accordion, piano, clarinet, and double bass, and was impressed by its individuality and imagination. I asked her if she had anything for piano. At the time, she was writing a work for accordion, choir, and orchestra, and she added a piano to turn it into a double concerto. She works with sound and musical gesture in a very physical way. We worked closely together on the latest concerto, To an Utterance, and it's been fascinating developing the various pianistic techniques. It's really loud. Earplugs loud. And incredibly moving. From the BBC Music Magazine for June of 2021, Ashutosh Kandahar conducts an investigation of the supernatural in opera. From its very beginnings in the Italian Renaissance, opera was an attempt to recreate a form of classical theater that might help us, through storytelling and music, to understand the nature of our existence in a terrifying and limitless universe. Mythical gods, sorcerers, ghosts, monsters, things that go bump in the night, the world of the supernatural is woven into the fabric of opera, heightened by music that colors and guides our emotional and psychic response. The operatic voice itself is, in a sense, supernatural, an extreme form of expression that projects the inner lives of characters onto a vast canvas, providing a perfect vehicle for inspiring awe and terror. In many Romance languages, the word for singing is derived from the Latin cantare, whose origins lie in casting of spells or incantations. Some of the earliest examples of the supernatural in opera revolve around the subversive qualities of witchcraft and sorcery. In Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, the witches who lure Aeneas away from Carthage represent what was regarded in 17th century England as the pernicious, destabilizing influence of Roman Catholicism. Handel's opera Alcina warns of the malignant effects of the supernatural on Enlightenment ideals, luring men to her island. The eponymous sorceress turns them into beasts. Witches and sorcerers continued to fascinate composers into the 19th century. In Rossini's Armida, the protagonist is an infidel temptress who uses magic to try to steer the knight Rinaldo away from his Christian mission in the Crusades. Perhaps the most famous of all operatic witches are those that appear in Verdi's Macbeth. In a departure from Shakespeare's Three Weird Sisters, Verdi has a large female chorus of witches divided into 3 parts, singing music that veers from the grotesque to the ribald. Verdi himself wanted the witches to appear trivial, yet extravagant and original. But many commentators have regarded them as a failure to capture the fantastical and fatalistic atmosphere of Shakespeare's apparitions. The late Verdi scholar Julian Budden wrote that the jaunty music in the first witch's chorus, quote, does not add up to anything very terrifying, though it at least captures the essentially childish malice of the witches in the play. For modern stage directors, Verdi's witches have provided fodder for ironic commentaries on what constitutes the notion of terror among an opera-loving public. In his 2007 production of Macbeth, Richard Jones memorably portrayed them as working-class single mothers living in a trailer park, bursting out of their caravans to scare the living daylights out of a mild-mannered Glyndebourne audience. For Enlightenment thinkers in the 18th century, the supernatural world was full of irrational elements that held humanity back in the pursuit of a progressive, morally driven world. In Mozart's The Magic Flute, opposing forces of darkness and light are expressed in the musical extremes of the writing for voice. The Queen of the Night's stratospheric, otherworldly coloratura sets the heart racing with alarm. In contrast, Zoroastro's deep, calm, almost soporific arias draw us back into a world of order and reason. Music's role in a world of discord is to restore a sense of harmony. Hence, Tamino's flute and Papageno's bells, which can banish evil spirits, tame wild beasts, and overcome terrifying ordeals. So much of Mozart's music embodies the ideals of the Enlightenment, a world of reason and order in which man is at peace with his gods. So, whenever supernatural forces intrude into his operas, Mozart is prompted to explore extraordinary sound worlds that shake us to the core. The ominous chords that reverberate from the orchestra at the start of Don Giovanni come back to haunt us quite literally as the plot unfolds. Mozart's rare use of trombones in each of Don Giovanni's terrifying encounters with the Commendatore statue are instances in which the composer conjures a supernatural world through cataclysmic shifts in harmony and strange, jangling orchestral textures and colors. The influence of the supernatural on the development of orchestral and choral color is at its most remarkable in Weber's Die Freischütz, premiered 2 centuries ago this year and considered to be the first romantic opera. At the end of Act II, we are plunged into one of the most celebrated scenes of supernatural horror in all opera. Lured into the wolf's glen at night, our hunting hero Max enters into a Faustian pact with the evil Caspar, who is in league with devilish Samuel as they forge magic bullets that never miss their mark. Weber sets the scene with tremulous strings underpinned by chromatic chords, descending as if into the depths of hell. Forbidding incantations from the male chorus are punctuated with horrifying shrieks from the women. This dark, turbulent sound world is familiar to modern audiences by way of 1,000 spooky scenes on TV and in horror films. But to audiences in 1821, this was a highly original and quite terrifying theatrical musical account of supernatural forces in action. Both Mozart and Weber supplied musical templates for supernatural scenes in operas throughout the 19th century. In Verdi's Don Carlos, somber trombone-heavy brass chords, shifting uneasily from major to minor, evoke an atmosphere of fear in the haunted monastery where the hapless Carlos is dragged to his death by the ghost of Charles V. The netherworld of Don Giovanni is palpable in Verdi's orchestral writing in this terrifying scene. Tchaikovsky, meanwhile, spoke of both Don Giovanni and Die Freischütz as being among his favorite operas, models for the eerie, fatalistic scenes featuring the old countess in The Queen of Spades. In his review of the Russian premiere of Die Freischütz, Tchaikovsky recognized a mighty creative force in Weber's depiction of the fantastic. Meyerbeer, one of the most popular opera composers of the 19th century, was a close friend of Weber. The two had studied composition together in Darmstadt. His opera Robert le Diable was premiered in 1831, a decade after Der Freischütz. A massive hit with the public of the day, it took the theatrical staging of the supernatural to a new level, establishing the tradition of grand opera in France. Meyerbeer's opera includes a ballet in which a group of deceased nymphomaniac nuns rise from their tomb to perform an infernal dance. The scene caused a sensation at its Paris opera premiere, not least because it showed off the theater's new gas lighting, a technological innovation that transformed the way the supernatural could be presented on the stage. Edgar Degas, for one, was transfixed by the haunting quality of light in the scene, painting it several times. Der Freischütz, meanwhile, made a profound impact on Wagner, who saw the opera as a 9-year-old in Dresden, conducted by Weber himself. You can hear Weber's influence throughout Wagner's works, and especially in his evocation of otherworldly terror when he deploys deep brass and woodwind resonances together with chilling vocal sound effects, such as the shrieking of the Valkyries in the Ring Cycle, or the haunting wailings of dead sailors on the ghost ship in The Flying Dutchman. Terror doesn't always, of course, come in noisy blasts. The supernatural world can be as seductive as it is frightening, and music's devilish power to seduce is a frequent theme in opera. In Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffmann, a catalogue of strange and sinister supernatural events, Antonia, a singer, is lured by the voice of her mother's ghost to sing herself to death. An even more unsettling example of the seductive power of singing can be heard in Britten's The Turn of the Screw. Here, the ghost of Peter Quint sings in soft, melismatic, quasi-erotic whisperings that simultaneously attract and repel the ill-fated young Miles. Britten's opera is a masterpiece in psychological horror, surpassing the creepiness of Henry James' novella on which it is based. The suspense is contained from start to finish as Britten winds the musical structure of his score tighter and tighter around a tortuous 12-tone row that ascends in the first act and descends in the second. The masterly use of the celeste and harp evokes the exotic, sensual appeal of the two ghosts, Quint and Miss Jessel, in their quest to seduce the souls of the two young children. In a world before Freud and psychoanalysis, one way that the subconscious could be expressed was through the supernatural. Ghosts can be explained as cathartic manifestations of unresolved psychic conflict. It seems no accident that Mozart wrote Don Giovanni, an opera in which the protagonist's bad behavior is met with severe punishment, shortly after the death of his father Leopold, a manipulative and judgmental presence in the composer's life. And Britten's Turn of the Screw, though written in a post-Freudian world, is addressed to a society in post-war Britain in which sex was still essentially repressed and many forms of sexuality were taboo. In this opera, the supernatural represents the fear of confronting who we really are. The story of the governess's unfulfilled infatuation is played out in the form of a supernatural struggle between good and evil. The resolution comes through the sacrifice of innocence. The idea of a supernatural world challenges man's sense of agency over his own destiny. Ghost stories and scenes of paranormal terror remind us how helpless we are in the face of things we cannot control. Indeed, being drawn to the supernatural is a very natural part of being human, a way of addressing life's abundant mystery. Opera, with its playful relationship with reality and its love of extremes, is an ideal art form for transporting us into worlds that lie in our imagination and beyond. In the August 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Eric Levy reveals the history behind Zemlinsky's Second Quartet. Few chamber music works convey emotional turbulence with such graphic intensity as Alexander Zemlinsky's String Quartet No. 2. Written between 1913 and 1915, this epic one-movement composition lays bare all the bitter disappointments he experienced on a personal and professional level after 1900. A doomed love affair with his composition pupil Alma Schindler, who left him to marry Gustav Mahler, had a particularly traumatic impact. But no less damaging was the decline in his fortunes as a composer. Following the award of the prestigious Beethoven Prize in 1897, and the considerable success enjoyed by his fairy tale opera Es war einmal, premiered at the Vienna Opera in 1900, Zemlinsky was fully expecting to make further waves in Viennese musical life. But his luck seems to have run out. The cancelled first performance of his next stage work, Der Traumgürge, or Gürge the Dreamer, was a cruel blow, not least because its removal came about not for artistic reasons, but because Felix Weingartner, Mahler's successor as director of the Vienna Opera, refused to program the work, even though it had already been placed into production. 3 years later, the lukewarm reception accorded his fourth opera, Kleider machen Leute, or Clothes Make the Man, effectively convinced Zemlinsky to leave the Austrian capital and relocate to Prague, where he became the conductor at the German Opera House. During this period, Zemlinsky's musical style moved far beyond the Brahmsian ambiance of his early years. Of particular significance was the close relationship he formed with Arnold Schoenberg, further cemented when the younger man married Zemlinsky's sister, Matilda. For many years, Zemlinsky was Schoenberg's mentor in musical matters, both composers pursuing an increasingly advanced musical idiom in response to the growing allure of Wagnerian chromaticism, features that are particularly evident in the Second Quartet's emotionally frenzied and dissonant expressionist writing. Nonetheless, Zemlinsky resisted the temptation to follow his younger contemporary down the path of atonality, and the strong rapport between the two men came under severe strain with the scandal that surrounded the suicide of the painter Richard Gerstel, who was having an affair with Schoenberg's wife. The harrowing autobiographical circumstances of Zemlinsky's long-standing infatuation for Alma Mahler, Gerstel's suicide, and his increasingly troubled relationship with Schoenberg are encapsulated in the Second Quartet through the use of musical ciphers, which serve to bind the work into a convincing entity. These include the composer's own musical cipher, DEG, heard at the very opening, a quotation from Schoenberg's Verklärte Nacht, and a four-note motif, ABDE, associated with Matilda. The Second Quartet is a highly volatile music drama. Yet, for all its seemingly impulsive changes of mood and tempo, Zemlinsky exercises a formidable control over the work's extended structure. It is possible, even on first hearing, to follow the logic of its narrative, which to all intents and purposes incorporates features that you'd find in a classical or romantic quartet. A passionate, dynamic opening section, which then unexpectedly subsides into a tripartite and emotionally eloquent slow movement. A sudden jolt in mood heralds a neurotic and shadowy scherzo and a more reflective trio before the quartet's final section. This builds up a real head of steam, working towards a ferocious climax marked by palpitating syncopated octaves in the viola, before collapsing into a more serene and reconciliatory slow epilogue. Zemlinsky entrusted the Rosé Quartet with the first performance, which took place in Vienna in April 1918. Most critics were hostile to the new work. One complained that Zemlinsky had challenged the fundamental discussion of what we still understand as music, whereas another failed to understand how such an esteemed musician could have fallen so readily under the spell of Schoenberg. However, according to Anton Webern, much of this antipathy could be explained by the Rosé Quartet's seeming inability to master such a musically complex and technically challenging work. Another ensemble, the Feist Quartet, championed the work far more to Webern's liking, and in subsequent years it featured several times in programs organized under the auspices of Schoenberg's Society for Private Music Performance. Yet after further performances in Prague and Berlin in the early 1920s, Zemlinsky's second completely disappeared from the repertoire. It fell out of vogue, primarily because its expressionist musical language no longer chimed with a more austere style in favor at that time. Revival of interest in Zemlinsky became impossible following the rise of the Nazis, who so airbrushed the composer out of Austrian musical history that he remained grievously neglected even after 1945. It was largely thanks to the LaSalle Quartet, whose pioneering LP recording for Deutsche Grammophon appeared in 1978, that Zemlinsky's second was rediscovered and received due recognition as one of the composer's most significant achievements. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for Classical Music Connection.